You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to a very early edition of Early BP. It's so early, I guess we could probably call it extra work today. I'm Mike Farron. We're changing the format up a little bit today because it is draft day, and we've spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks talking about how important this draft is. Here's why that's the case. The D-backs have seven of the top 75 picks. All seven of those picks will be taken tonight. The first-year player draft begins at 4 o'clock Arizona time. D-backs pick 16th. 26th overall, that's compensation for failing to sign first-round pick Matt McClain last year. They have comp picks at number 33 and 34, which are for qualifying offers being issued to Patrick Corbin and A.J. Pollock and them signing elsewhere. And then the D-backs have their second-round pick and two more picks at the end of the second round, 74th and 75th. One of those is a competitive balance pick that's given to teams that receive revenue sharing, and the other was acquired as part of the Paul Goldschmidt trade. As a result, the D-backs have nearly $17 million that they can spend in this draft without incurring penalties into next year. It is an exorbitant amount, the second highest in the hard slotting system. So the D-backs have a chance to really change the complexion of the franchise, even though they're picking in the middle of the first round. With that in mind, we wanted to get you a couple of interviews that we did last week. We had a chance to visit with scouting director Derek Ladnier. You heard from him last Monday in a lengthy interview talking a little bit about the nuts and bolts of building the draft board. This will go more into the process of how they started to identify players going back to last year. And up next, we'll visit with assistant general manager Amiel Sadai. Sadai helped to oversee the Boston Red Sox draft in 2011, where they had four of the first 40 picks, a similar situation to what the D-backs have this year. So our early BP today focuses on the first-year player draft getting underway later this afternoon. And here's our conversation with Amiel Sadai.
What does having seven of the first 75 picks mean?
Obviously, it means it's a chance for us to just infuse some talent into the organization. It's a really unique opportunity. And I know I've said this in the past. And, it's a transformational draft. I mean, it can transform your farm system from a mid-level farm system to a top-tier farm system very quickly. And obviously, we got to be right on those picks, and that's what we're doing right now. But it's really special, and it doesn't happen. It's never happened for me to have this many picks, and so it's an exciting opportunity.
What has to happen for it to be a successful draft?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, I want to say go 7 for 7 or 8 for 8 in big leaguers, and I use the reference, it's like playing Keno, right? Like, you never go 8 for 8. I mean, if you do, you're probably not working here. Obviously, you want to get a lot of really good players, and some are going to create value for the organization in different ways. A lot of them hopefully play in the big leagues for us, and, you know, we want to be able to get these guys up and through our system, develop them, teach them the D-back way. You know, we want to get hitters that control the strike zone, have good approaches, and pitchers that throw a lot of strikes and are aggressive. And so it gives us an opportunity to do that. And sometimes, when you trade for players, they have different mentalities or different things ingrained in them. And we have an ability to do this from the ground up.
What are some of those ways that they can provide value to the organization outside of reaching the big leagues?
A lot of these kids probably aren't going to reach the big leagues, a lot of the kids in the draft. And some ways to create value is just being great teammates, right? Like helping others, I think, whether it's both as a person or in the lineup. Obviously, getting to the big leagues is the primary goal, but maybe helping others that do get to the big leagues, I hate to say this, but sometimes creating value by obviously when your team's in it and you end up trading those players, and our hope is that they're all D-backs, but we have to be realistic about that. That's usually not the case. If we're trading a player to another team, that means our big league team's good, and that's what we hope for too.
You said before that you haven't had a bounty like this, but in 2011, you did have four first-round picks in Boston.
what did you learn from that experience that you take into this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the situation was a little different. We had four of the top 40, which is probably similar to this, but the rules were a little different back then. I mean, we cast a really wide net. We spent a lot of time on a certain group of players. I think back then we probably, there were more players in play in a smaller group, and we didn't have, in this I guess this bounty of picks, we pick in every like 20 picks, right? And I think after 40, we didn't pick again for another 40 picks or something like that. So we were able to eliminate a good chunk of players that we thought were tweeners. This, we took like 40 players and we really got to know them, you know, whether it was 20 or 30 players that we really got to know, we thought we had a chance to. And we also were able to take a little bit of risk. You know, we took obviously Blake Swihart, who's now with the D-backs, and he was a guy that was rumored to be unsignable at the time. And so we took that risk on him because we felt like we had other picks that we could take. And ultimately we ended up signing him. But, you know, you're able to do that. And I think, you know, who knows, maybe we'll do that this week. But I think just being able to diversify your portfolio is always exciting.
In that draft, the best player that came out of it was a fifth rounder in Mookie Betts, right? When the Diamondbacks had a windfall of picks in 2009, the best player to come out of the draft was Paul Goldschmidt, was an eighth rounder. You mentioned it was a different system then. Is it harder to find those guys, to get those players later in a draft now than it used to be?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think more, a lot of teams are doing very similar things. You know, there's like the kind of the advancement in technology and the advancement in analytics and things that probably 10 years ago, maybe teams didn't do. Some teams do that now. It's like you hear probably 28 of the 30 teams are really, maybe even 30 that do it. So yeah, I think it is still, it's difficult enough to find a really good player at the top of the draft, and our scouts did a great job on Mookie, and that's kind of what led us to taking Mookie Betts. And I know the scouts here did a great job on Paul Goldschmidt. I still think there's a way to do it, right? There are going to be fifth rounders and ninth rounders and tenth rounders that are going to be really good players and probably all-stars, and probably guys that when you redo the draft should be first rounders. It just makes you got to work a little bit harder, and your scouts have to do a little bit more digging, but... You know, and the other thing is, I think in the age of social media, nobody gets unnoticed, right? They just put a clip on Twitter, and then everyone runs in to see them. And you hear area scouts now tell you, oh, how did you find that guy? And say, oh, I saw a tweet about him, and I watched the video, and he looked good. And so I drove down and saw him, and he was pretty good. So I think that it's a way to kind of sell yourself. And these kids and agents are smart, and they're doing it. And so I think 10 years ago, you didn't have that, obviously.
So the pitching ninja is ruined for a
dog. The pitching ninja hasn't fully gotten into the draft the way he probably, if he does, he could probably change the dynamics too. So yeah.
Let's talk about the hard slot system. You have the second largest pool since this system went into place. Was it 8 years ago, 9 years ago now? What are ways that you can use that financial muscle and flexibility on draft day?
Yeah, I mean, it gives you ways to be creative. I mean, you can walk in, and the way I always say, you could just go, buy the books, right? And never have to save money on anyone, never overspend in a specific slot, and you'd be fine. You'll probably have really good players out of it. Or you could be creative because there are some guys that have options, whether they're high school guys that may slide in the draft. It allows you to be able to be creative and dynamic, right? You could think on the fly and say, okay, our strategy is, wow, this guy's sliding in the draft. Well, we have so much money, we could pay this guy a little bit later. Maybe we have to save a little bit of money here, but okay, it doesn't matter because we have $16 million in our pool. And so I think that there are ways, without getting into the minutia of the understanding of the draft pool dynamics, it just allows you to be creative and spend money in different places. And you don't have to just take a player at 16, a player at 26, a player at 33 and give them the exact slot. And I think that's what most teams do now, right? Like there is a way of diversifying, spreading your money out as, and some people think that's the best strategy. And, you know, we'll see what we do. We usually don't make that decision until draft day.
What are some of the dangers of not just playing it straight in terms of we're taking the best player available regardless of either signability or just the way we have them slotted on the board?
Yeah, I mean, I think you sometimes you get too cute. You know, typically if you're taking some of these guys that may slide and have higher price tags, there's probably a little more risk in those guys because they're high school guys, and you may have had a college guy, for example, that has performed and gone out and shown you 3 years in the SEC, but you know, he's a little bit closer to what you know who he is, and you mitigate the risk by taking that player. But now all of a sudden you see the sexier high school guy, it's riskier. You don't know as much about those players. So, you know, by doing that, obviously you're kind of layering in a little bit more risk. There may be more upside, at least on the draft day, it seems like there's more upside. But it's also riskier.
Because your pool is so big, the 5% overage without penalty is also large. What does that buffer create for you guys?
Tough to say. I mean, honestly, like, you don't have to, you know, a lot of times there are teams that don't go into the 5%, and we haven't made a decision as to if we would do it. If you choose to do it, you know, if a team chooses to do it, it allows you to just kind of dig a little bit deeper and into your pockets, obviously spend a little bit more money, and you get a small, there's obviously a financial penalty that goes along with it. But you know, we haven't made the decision whether or not it's something we would do, because I think it just all depends on the type of, you don't want to just spend money to spend money. I mean, the money's real, obviously. So it just depends on the types of players you have out there.
A lot of times people come in to run an organization, they make changes. You inherited Derek Ladner and wanted to keep him as scouting director. Why?
I think Derek did a really good job of, you know, look, the game has changed a lot in what we know, what we see on a day-to-day basis. And a lot of what you have to do is you have to be adaptable. And, you know, I think walking into this, you know, completely different way of probably operating, the way we operated to the way maybe Derek was used to operating, yeah, he could have been stubborn. He could have fought it, which a lot of people probably, and not just in baseball, in other industries, probably do when a new manager, a new boss comes in, and they get upset. You know, Derek showed us the ability to be adaptable, and you know, he's a seasoned evaluator. He's run a lot of draft rooms. He's earned the respect of all the scouts in that room. He manages the staff extremely well. People like him. I mean, he's a very affable person and personality. And we have a good relationship. Derek and I can argue about things, and Mike Hazen too. I mean, we could sit here, the three of us, and argue about something, and he's not afraid to speak his mind and say, this is who I would take, or I understand this is who you guys want to take. We're all going to disagree at times, but at the end of the day, we come to a consensus, and I think that's the most important thing. And Derek's done a great job with his staff and also with us. I mean, he's, you know, he's a easy guy to kind of work with. And one of the things that I probably didn't mention is from an analytics perspective, you know, you have a kind of a tried and true old timer scout evaluator who's out there, and he could completely, which a lot of guys probably have done and would do, just alienate the analytics and the R&D part of it. And instead, he's kind of gone complete opposite, right? He is ingrained, you know, those guys are ingrained in our process. And it's something that we've talked about. And now you walk in and we have our R&D guys in the room, and they have as much of an opinion as the scouts. And our scouts, they all get along. And I think that the collaboration is a testament to Derek and his staff.
Analytics has become a catch-all. It's not just about the numbers anymore. How is the technology in objective data collection help to change the room?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, without going into too many trade secrets, I mean, I think you're right. There's a lot of different things, from performance, just basic performance data, to you know, batted ball data, to pitch data. It changes the room because you have different analysts that focus on different parts of the draft, or different, trying to think of the right, like different
categories,
or trying to think of how you would, and so we may look to a pitching guy for one piece of information, a guy who focuses on some of our catching data for another piece of information. So there's, we probably run three or four guys in the draft room that that have spent some time on the draft through the year, R&D guys that spent some time in the draft, and so we kind of call on different people. There's a lot of information out there, and we use a lot of it to the degree we try to marry it. We don't overemphasize the analytics part over the scouting. We try to marry it, and we also realize that there's another component to the draft and drafting a player that the numbers can't tell us, and it's a lot of, about the makeup and what makes this guy tick. And without having a scout in there, or scouts that know this player, that can kind of pound the table and vouch for this player, you can draft the wrong guy. And that's the minor leagues are really, really difficult. And, a lot of times we see these guys that come fly through the minor leagues in a year or two. That's an anomaly, right? I mean, most of these guys are going to face some adversity, and we need to know what makes these guys tick. And so the makeup component to it is a big part of it.
D-Max Assistant General Manager Amiel Sadai, and that's part of the reason why the Major League Baseball draft is so tricky. Most of these players will not be in the big leagues anytime soon. And so fans have to spend extra time trying to keep up with them if they want in the minor leagues, and they can be tricked by performance in a hitter-friendly league like the Cal League, or this year the Southern League, where the D-backs AA franchise is not a great league for hitters, and so you can get fooled one way or the other on numbers for both hitters and pitchers. And it's a number of years before you start to see them matriculate to the big leagues, especially if it's a high school player. Though the success rate generally is such that the vast majority of players that put up all-star caliber seasons are those that are drafted early in the draft. Still, you can have some finds late, and that's something the D-backs organization has actually excelled at, regardless of who's been in charge over the last 20 years. One of the most successful scouting directors in baseball is Derek Ladner. He was not with the Kansas City Royals when they won the World Series in 2015, but the drafts that he had there helped to shape that franchise. Players like Mike Moustakas, Eric Hosmer, Greg Holland, even Zach Greinke, who he took in the first round and was later traded for key pieces of their championship squad, including Lorenzo Cain and Alcides Escobar. He is the D-backs amateur scouting director. This is his fifth draft with the D-backs, and we had a chance to visit with him about how this process started for 2019.
When did you first realize that this was going to be the mega draft, like how important this year's draft was going to be?
I mean, honestly, we had an idea as soon as the draft was over last year how this thing could potentially unfold. And obviously, things happen, things don't happen. Players sign, players don't sign. But we had to plan for what we're doing right now, and understanding if we didn't have all the picks, we'd still be prepared for it. So I can honestly say that we started as soon as the draft ended. Everybody goes out to the East Coast Pro and area codes and the Cape Cod, and a lot of emphasis. Not that it really changed the way we were doing things, because just because you have more picks doesn't mean you change how you cover these players. There was just an understanding of when we were watching these players that this bucket, this pool of players, was going to be far greater than what we had ever had before, at least during my time in this organization. I know in the past they had some where they had a big haul, which was a great draft for this organization, and that's kind of the way we've approached it. Is if we can do as well as they did the last time, then we'll be in pretty good shape.
Yeah, it was 10 years ago. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
They had that opportunity in 2009. So let's go through the mechanics of what that summer is like. Is that identifying players? How do you deploy your amateur scouting department to, I guess, build your in-season prep list?
Well, I mean, it literally, when I tell you, it starts immediately. And fortunately for us this year, it's going to start this year here, because we host the Perfect mm-hmm. Games, which is a great venue for this organization. But it literally, I mean, all of the guys are assigned various tournaments. You have East Coast Pro, you have area codes. They've got an elite league that they're going to be having down at the IMG facility with the top 80 players, high school players, for next year's draft. That's basically what we did. I mean, you go to all of these events. the guys turn in follow reports, just like they're scouting them for a draft in, let's say, November, okay? And the guys go to the Cape, they turn in their reports. Smaller looks, because a lot of times, especially on the pitcher side, they throw two or three innings and then they're out. And then in the Cape, you see these guys, and you know, you're seeing them in the Wood Bat League against some of the better competitions. You've got the Alaskan League, all of the various collegiate leagues we cover. So we basically take the reports from that summer. We put them in some sort of a pref list based upon the value that our scouts have put on that type of player. And we put that in a bucket at the end of the summer. Then we go into the fall where the high schools aren't playing, but the colleges are, and now they can play games. So the guys, they hit the fall. They start doing, you know, a lot of the in-home visits, speaking with the kids. We try to do a lot of that during the summer. And they look at those guys in the fall, turn in reports once again, put those in a bucket, and then we blend those with the high school kids and the collegiate reports that we had from the summer. And basically we get together, let's say November, sometime in November. I like to always do it prior to the winter meeting so that I have an understanding as to who the top players are. So if you have to speak with agents or whatnot, you have a better idea. And then I like to have in January what I call a mock draft, to where you take all of those follows, these players that we're talking about right now, understanding that some guys are going to get elevated, some guys are going to go down. But you try to have basically, I do, and I've always done it, I mean, even back to my old days as a scouting director, is have a mock draft going into the spring to prioritize the guys to see how much of a difference there is in their rankings once we get into these meetings that we're having right now, and then compare and, you know, why is a guy lower, why is a guy higher? A lot of times it's performance-based, and or, you know, especially with high school players, there's a growth spurt where the guy that was throwing 88 to 91 in the summer is now 93, 95 with a curveball. It changes. There's a big difference between the juniors and the seniors. The college guys, usually, they're similar to what we've seen. I mean, there may be a few guys that get a little bit better, or they're coming off of an injury. And start putting the board together from number one all the way down to the last report.
So go to the mock draft for a second. Is it just you doing it, or is it you and your top lieutenants? How do you build, like, who's in that room building the mock draft that becomes the in-season?
It's all of the guys that are in this room right now. I mean, obviously the intensity level is not what it is. The attention to detail is nowhere near what it is now, because there's a lot of information, medical information, eye tests, things like that, that we probably don't have yet. So we don't really include that. It's basically a draft that's put together, a board based upon their physical ability, excluding everything else. And I mean, all the guys will be there. I mean, Amiel Hayes will be there. All the cross checkers will be there. You know, sometimes like the special assistants, they're out doing other stuff, so they're not involved in that. But we'll sit in there and grind it out for, and we make it short. It's a 3-day thing. You know, this is much more drawn out for obvious reason, but it just gives us perspective on the level of talent and, you know, the pool of players that we're going to be looking at, so that when we do come into the spring, we have targets, you know, prioritized targets. And that's how we've done it this year.
How similar does the board shape up to the way that list looked?
In theory, it should be perfect. Reality is that it's not. And there's a lot of factors that go into that. There's injuries, like I said, there's underperformers, there's overperformers, and you don't want to put too much emphasis on overperformers and underperformers based upon track record and history. But I think the one thing that we do a great job of here is track record and history. And, you know, to say it's drastically different, that would be inaccurate, because I think our guys have done a really good job of identifying the guys that we're talking about. I mean, there's always going to be those exceptions that might have been, I don't want to say all the way on the end of your board, that end up high on your board, but sometimes there's significant jumps in either way for various reasons. And the factors that I talked about, guy gets stronger, guy. But I think the guys have done a really good job of identifying the guys a long time ago that are on that board right now.
I want to hit on just a couple of things you brought up. So track record versus performance. How do you balance that both ways? Where guy, good track record, bad season, no track record, great season. Yeah. I think it probably applies to the college guys. It applies to a pretty prominent college player in this one.
That's actually a great question, because most people wouldn't even think about that. But it's really, I mean, this is where analytics come in too. I mean, it's where you start looking at how they've performed against velocity, how they've performed against sliders, curveballs, whatever the case may be, their ability to elevate the ball. all of those things factor into, let's say somebody's having a bad year and we really liked them. We thought this guy was going to be, and we've seen cases where guys have bad years and they end up being really great players, or they had an injury, you know, filled year to where they weren't basically scouted the way that they normally would have been had they been healthy. All of those things factor into that. I mean, and if a guy is underperforming, obviously it's devastating to him, but we may not change our view other than this guy's, I mean, you've heard the term draftitis. It's a real term. I mean, it happens to these guys. And because of all of the emphasis that's put on them, I mean, there's obviously a lot of media coverage for this, and the kids are trying to live up to the hype. And sometimes it gets a little bit overwhelming for them. And you try not to read too much into that, because we've all been there. I know me as an athlete in the past. I mean, you get it. You know, you read the articles. You look at your stats. You look who's in the stands, things like that. So I just try to look at it as a body of work that we put together. If a guy's having a bad year, it doesn't necessarily change unless there's some significant problems that we're seeing. I mean, and some of the guys, maybe they've picked up bad habits as a hitter, but we saw them the year before and we said, this guy can really hit. He's just, for whatever reason, he went to a hitting guru and the guy says, I'm going to make you even better, and it's made him worse. So in my mind, I'm still thinking that this guy still has the aptitude to do what he did before. And sometimes it helps you because he slides in the draft because of performance. And you get a guy in a little later pick than where you thought you originally have, and he ends up being a really good player.
What about on the flip side of that? Guy doesn't have much track record, all of a sudden, breakout season or pop-up guy.
That's dangerous. I'll be honest. I mean, there are guys that it happens to, but there's much more pause when we start trying to get this guy up there because he's having this monster season. I've seen cases where guys have, you know, had monster seasons, and then they go out for whatever reason. They're having a great season. And maybe it's true. But I know in that room that there's a lot more caution for that guy because, like I said, the track record and history of success far outweighs the guy who's just having that monster season and you're not really sure if you believe it or not for whatever reason. I mean, there's all kinds of different thought processes on that. You're not going to deny what somebody's doing, but the track record and history, especially when you're talking about high in the draft and significant amount of money, your investment, you'd like to have a lot more track record and history.
College versus high school, obviously, is a big discussion. Let's start with high school bats. We've seen a lot of studies that age is a huge factor in that. How do you weigh the upside of that versus the floor of a college performer?
Well, I mean, the college performers, obviously, there's a lot more history with a guy, especially competing at higher levels of competition, because many of these guys that are really good hitters, they're not facing guys that are throwing 90-plus. They're facing guys that are, you know, throwing 80 miles an hour, 85, so they should dominate the competition. It's a balance that you try to put into your draft. I mean, I always feel like it's important to get a combination of both if you can. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. But when you start talking about high school bats really high in the draft, they're usually guys that you feel like that if you put them in the middle of the lineup in some of these major colleges, that they would do exactly what they're doing right now in high school. And that's just, that really comes down to the evaluation process of watching them. That's why the summer becomes so important, is these high school bats. We see them against guys that are throwing 93, 94, 95 miles an hour in all of these showcases. So you get to see if they can hit velocity. Can they hit guys that can spin the ball? So that summer coverage of those high school hitters, there's a lot of importance and emphasis put on that. And their success in those leagues. I mean, if they struggled against it, well, that's a red flag for us. But if they dominated it and they hit it, that gives us a better indicator that this guy's going to be able to get into professional baseball and have immediate success.
What is the biggest challenge in evaluating high school arms?
Oh, boy.
What are the biggest challenges? How's
I've,
that?
I've always said I'm all in favor of taking high school pitchers. Just make sure you take the right ones.
Round 3 through 10 last year, a lot of college arms, a lot of Friday starters. What is it about college arms that stand out the most?
Well, once again, we get into the track record and history of those guys. And sometimes those guys that you take in the third, fourth, or fifth round, whether it's perception, whatever the case may be, they're not that big of a difference between maybe the guy you're going to take in the first or second round. And there's always a lot more arms than there are per hitters, because hitters go really fast in the draft, as you well know. And there's a lot more arms that are available. So the guys that we like that aren't too far away from some of those upper tier guys, I think you have a better probability of getting a big leaguer in some role. I mean, whether he's a starter, whether he's a reliever, And I think we've done a really good job over the years that we've been here of finding those type guys. And I think over time you'll start seeing more and more of them in the big leagues here. I mean, we've got two guys right now that were third rounders. So that'll give you an idea why I truly believe in that.
I know we're up against it here. I want to ask you just one more in building out the draft board. I know you and I talked about this the other day, but just in building it out, as you get to setting that final order, what's the number one biggest challenge in being able to walk away from it and go, it's done?
Well, all right. Bottom line is there's rarely ever going to be a complete and total consensus in a draft room. That's the reality of it. People see players in different ways. But as you go around the room, and it's a large room, and you've got a lot of very talented people that listen to other people, and you listen to them listen to other people, and it kind of forms their opinion, maybe different than what they saw, based upon what somebody else says, because, there's a lot of respect. And the one thing that I always want these guys to do is not only have their opinion, but have the ability to listen to other people's opinion. And I think all of our guys do a good job of that. So when we start talking about these players, when we do line that board up and it's, okay, it's showtime, I think everybody feels really good about it because, first off, they've all been listened to. They've all been respected. Their opinion's been put on that board. And then ultimately, the decision makers have to make decisions, and I think they respect that.
Derek Ladnier, D-backs amateur scouting director, joining us here on Early BP. And the D-backs first pick should happen about 5:35 Arizona time tonight. We'll have more on that on the BP show at 6 on 98.7 FM, Arizona Sports Station in the Valley, and on the D-backs network and on MLB.com. The second pick, they'll be on the clock around 6:30, so right before first pitch. So by the time the D-backs start the game tonight, we will know a lot more about who they are taking or who they have taken on the first round of the draft. We'll keep you updated throughout the broadcast. We'll have plenty more information on the BP show for you with regards to the draft, so we'll get into that as well. And lots to do today on what's a pretty important day for the D-backs franchise and news fans. I know you're excited about the next generation of D-back stars, so a couple of hatchlings coming into the organization tonight. So make sure you tune in on the radio tonight. D-backs taking on the Los Angeles Dodgers. First pitch 6:40 with Greg and Tom. Robbie Ray against Walker Buehler, the pitching matchup, and we will update you on all of the activity through the first day and the first seven picks the D-backs have in the first-year player draft today. Thanks for joining us for some early BP.